I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I extend my respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners that we have joining us. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
The last afternoon that he was around, he died on a Wednesday, I think it was at about 6 o'clock, and about 2 o'clock that afternoon, he said, his mum and dad, I want to touch the earth with my feet one more time. And his mum and dad said they stood him up in his room, and he said to his mum, like, Mum, tell my mates to love life and don't waste it.
In the words of Tommy Herschel, one conversation can shift change in a young person forever. Tommy Herschel is a school teacher by trade and the founder of Find Your Feet, a non-for-profit organisation that has the vision to empower everyone with the tools and skills to engage in conversations that change their lives. Tommy spends his time travelling around the world to deliver impactful workshops to save the lives of young people, what he calls the best job in the world. Today you'll hear countless stories from Tommy of the lives he's impacted, as well as details of his own trauma and mental health journey. I will warn you, this episode is quite intense, so I suggest you skip this one if you're feeling personally affected by mental health or suicide. There are also mentions of sexual assault and human trafficking. Please reach out to one of the many resources we've provided in the show notes below. For those who do listen, this is a story of hope. As Tommy shows us, there is always hope. This is Life Chats, deep and meaningful conversations with friends and strangers. Let's basically just dive in. Your tagline on your socials is "A solid conversation can shift change in a fella forever." Where did that come from?
Well, yeah, that's, mate, straight into it.
Let's go.
Yeah, that's everything with Find Your Feet, like, has a story or it has ingredients to it. So it's not just let's just put a line to something. That was for a really long time for me. I was the sort of fella who would drink 15 cans of beer a day, be the life of the party during the day, go home, cry myself to sleep. My wife would be upset, obviously, with the little boy that she was sort of living with in me. And I always used to ring this one mate all the time, like 1 or 2 in the morning. And I'd cry down the phone to him and I'd say, no one knows what it's like. And this would always follow an argument with my wife. And no one knows what it's like. No one cares, you know. My dad doesn't love me, never has. And my mate would just listen, you know, he'd just listen all the time and put up with it. And one night he literally just said, mate, F off. Like, he just said down the phone, you know, he's an older fella. He said, mate, I'm done with you ringing me like this.
Wow.
Like, I'm sick of it.
He called you out.
Yeah, he goes, I love you. I love you so much. And that's why I'm doing this. You know, that's why we're going to have this conversation, because you ring me every night, you do the easy thing, you get drunk every day, you're not facing up to your shit, you're not owning your shit. All you're doing is whinging about it. He said, ring me tomorrow when you're sober. I love you so much. But he goes, also love myself, and I've got to stand up for myself. He said, I love your wife. She's an amazing woman. You know, there's a standard that she expects. He said, but yeah, don't do this anymore. So yeah, I rang him the next day, and that was sort of that one solid conversation that realistically saved my life. At the time, he was going through a huge, you know, like a massive trauma. He'd lost his son. His son had been shot by police in a mental health episode. Yet I was so clouded that I didn't even ever look at his grief. I would just ring him because he was the guy that would answer the phone. But, yeah, eventually one night he said, mate, no more. Like, I've had enough. Yeah, I love you, but call me tomorrow when you're sober.
That's so powerful. Do you think that that conversation kind of was the start of the shift for you? Because I'm sure we'll get into it, but was alcohol a pretty severe problem at that time? Was that kind of how you were leaning on?
Yeah, that was everything.
Yeah.
That was how I did it all. It was my addiction.
How old were you at this point? Sorry.
That's a good question. I was 35. It was the 10th of February, 2017.
Every alcoholic remembers the day.
Yeah,
The final, or like the day of change.
Yeah, the day of change. I mean, that was the day that my relationship went with alcohol, from being the tool that allowed me to be emotional and be angry and be the funny guy, because that's what we're allowed to do when we're drunk. You know, we're allowed to ring someone the next day and go, oh, gee, shit, Robbo, sorry about last night, mate. You know, I might have done some. And you go, it doesn't matter, mate, you were pissed. Or, mate, I'm sorry. You know, did I tell you last night I loved you a fair few times and cried? Yeah, mate, doesn't matter. You know, you were pissed. So for me, it was awesome because it would allow me to do all those things and show everyone how angry I was about what was going on in my life. But then it was also stopping me from doing all the hard things, which is being honest and real. So for me now, like I'll be completely honest, I'm not completely sober. I have a beer every now and again. I love non-alcoholic beers now for me, like it's because I love a taste of a beer. And so I've been really lucky, you know, Heaps Normal's been amazing with Find Your Feet. And they've thrown us some beer. And so, you know, I love being able to go to a barbecue and have three or four of them and that's it. And then there's times when I go, gee, that's a nice, you know, stout over there. I'll try that one. And it's gone to like, wow, that's, I love the taste of that. But if I've got the mindset now, if I have two, three or four, anxiety kicks in and I'm not the man that I need to be. So, yeah, it's very, very limited these days. Yeah.
Amazing. Let's backtrack a bit because I feel like we dove straight in, but I want to kind of get an understanding of like who you were as a young Tom or young Tommy and the kind of formative experiences and things that inspired you. But I guess a lot of the work you do is grounded in the fact that it's okay for men to be emotional and okay for men to feel and talk about their emotions. Growing up in your household, was that something that was normalized or what was your dad like?
No, it wasn't normalised at all. It's interesting. I try and think of my childhood a lot and I don't have many memories from the age of being born through to 10 years of age. And, you know, my old man worked his ass off. He was a truck driver. He drove cabs. He did everything like that. So he wasn't around too much. I don't remember seeing him around too much. But I guess for me, that when my oldies split up, what I was met with was dialogue like, you know, get on with it from him, like harden up, you'll be right, it's not fair or all that sort of thing. So that was the mentality that I was given and that was the dialogue that I was given. So, yeah, there was no emotion, but I was the complete opposite. I was a little fella that was very soft, as in like soft as in beautiful soft, sensitive. The word soft's been absolutely ruined, you know. I was soft, I was warm, I was, you know, I loved hugs, all those sort of things, but they were pretty absent, I guess. There was a lot of things going on and I used to suffer severely from anxiety. But, you know, back then, as it, you know, I'm talking 30 years ago, it wasn't called anxiety. It was called homesickness.
Wow.
You know, that sort of thing. I never remember hearing the word anxiety.
At what age did you feel like it clicked for you, that anxiety maybe wasn't a normal experience or that other kids weren't feeling the same?
I was only explaining this to a group of kids the other day, like young fellas, that I used to go to swim training in the morning and this big Audio Dynamite song came on. And I'll do my best to sing it because it's classic when I try and sing videos. Let's have a time. You know that tune?
No.
I'm doing some shit. But even when I sing it now, like I go into this like.
You remember?
I go straight back. It used to come on every day on the Gold Coast, CFM at 8:15. That was just when we'd finished swim training at Crum and Pool. And I would hear it and I don't know what it was, but I'd just panic and I'd think Dad was driving a truck, Dad's going to have a crash, hope Mum's going to be all right today. I'd get on my push bike. This is before mobile phones. I'd get on my push bike. I'd ride home as hard as I could, which was 20 minutes down the road, and I'd get home and I'd get my dog and I'd tie it up to like a rope about this tight, and I'd just be, and I remember my heart rate would just be through the roof. I'd get back to school and, you know, that was my day. Couldn't sleep at people's houses. I'd get to like 10, 11 o'clock at night, have a bit of a...
I'd be like, come pick me up.
Yeah, I just...
You just spiral somehow with no real cause or reason.
Yeah, exactly. So it was... That was for me, like when I saw a lot of other kids not experiencing that, I'd felt really on my own, isolated, and there was no explanation. Definitely not from me, but I guess this is why I love Find Your Feet so much is I was looking for an explanation or something from someone older than me, someone who'd experienced it or been through it, and if they were to simply to say, hey, mate, it's okay to be having a panic attack, it's okay to be having anxiety, like we're here for you, let's get you home. Instead, I used to get, you know, mates, dads be like, go on, I'll pay you $10. I dare you to stay. I dare you. You know, I'm not taking you. I've had
Be a man.
And I'd be there going, like, this is getting worse. So, yeah, I guess that's for me when it first really kicked in.
Did you ever feel like your dad, because I feel like the work you're doing is so amazing, because not only is it a problem for men or boys, like I really feel for young boys who, I guess things are changing, but generationally, who just weren't allowed to feel their feelings. Like, what an isolating experience to grow up kind of being told. And I guess this happens for women too in some circumstances, but like, you're not allowed to feel how you feel. You should just get on with things. And then you think there's something wrong with you for being emotional, being sensitive, when it's actually an incredible trait and allows you to empathize with people around the world. But was your dad ever emotional? Did you ever see him show emotion?
No, not really. I only ever heard stories of it. You know, I unfortunately don't speak to my old man anymore. And when I talk on that, you know, there's emotion in my voice. I've been thinking a lot about it lately. It's, you know, it sucks. It's your old man is like, I guess, your ultimate boss in a way. You want your boss to give you leadership, you want your boss to give you responsibilities, you want your boss to say, hey, like, well done on that job. But you also want your boss to love you and to acknowledge you and appreciate you. And I don't know, I guess for my old man and I, like, that relationship, there was a lot of stuff. Like, when him and mum split, he moved to far north Queensland, and I guess he never really came back. I sort of say that. Like, he's still up there. And I had this life of, mate, I'll see you in a few weeks. I'm coming down, I promise. And then that few weeks it happened, and nothing would come of it and wouldn't show up. And you know, like, I guess there's this thing that happens if you're in that job and you've got the boss that's constantly letting you down. You're like, I'm out of here. You know, like, I need that stability. And yeah, my old man, you know, and in his defense, his dad went to Second World War, and I reckon there's a huge war hangover, massive.
Totally.
War
it's
hangover.
Generational trauma, intergenerational trauma, they say.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I remember being at my grandparents' house, so his mum and dad's house, and my grandfather was hard as, you know, like, he'd hardly talk to you. When my dad moved to far north Queensland, I remember being at the airport and standing there, and I can still see it. I travel so much, I still remember the gate I was at in the airport. When I walked past it in Brizzy, I sort of try to ignore it.
Yep.
But my dad walked down the gangway to get on the plane with his wife, you know, his new partner and her daughter, and my grandfather looked at me and he goes, you should have gone with him, you weak bastard. Like,
oh, wow.
I was 11.
Wow.
And yeah, it's brutal. Like, I still think of those. They're the moments for me where this work really kicks in. And I guess you can see that in me now. It's like, I don't claim to be an expert. I live this stuff. And if I don't do it, those memories and those things really kick in and take over. And that's when I go back to the easy stuff of the bottle and drinking. So I remember, yeah, that night, like, driving back to the Goldie after my grandfather said that and my dad's flown away. And I remember just thinking, like, where's dad gone? Why has he gone north and what's happened? Where is he? I guess from that example of my grandfather, my old man never saw it at all. My grandmother told me an interesting story before she passed that was in the old days with the Vietnam War, your number would come up on the screen. And when my dad's birth date didn't come up, he went to the pub, you know, and for 3 days. And apparently when he came home to get a change of clothes, he walked in the house and the grandfather said to him, it's a shame you didn't get to go to war. It's the only thing that would make a man out of you. So my old man experienced it as well. And I guess this is the journey for me. Like, will I make up with my old man before he dies? Sure, I don't know. And that's a brutal.
Do you want to?
I don't know. I mean, for sure. Like, I'd be lying if I said the easy me. The old alcoholic me would be going, nah, fuck that, bugger that. He's a prick, he's this, he's that. But the new me would be like, I know he's got a story, but shit, there's a lot of work there. And at the moment, oh, you know, like, I'm really, my focus and my priority is my wife and kids.
Totally.
I put them
Your
through.
Family.
Yeah, I put them through hell. Yeah, so.
Do you speak to your dad at all? Was it a bit of like it just fizzled out, or was there a moment or an incident that kind of broke that relationship for you?
Yeah, that's an interesting one again, mate. There was a moment, a couple of moments. I guess there's that constant sort of letdown, but then the big moment for me was, you know, and this is a really personal one, but my grandma, his mum was passing away and he wasn't there, and he could have been there, and he didn't come. And my sisters and I spent the week, boy, next to her bedside. And I don't know if you ever sat with anyone who's passing away, but it's one of the most incredible experiences. you know, when you're lucky enough to be there, she was 101, wow. You know, so that's an incredible experience to sit next to a young person. I imagine would be not an incredible experience, but to sit with my grandmother and, you know, for the week slowly watching her pass and the smiles that would come on her face while her eyes were closed, to see my sisters looking after her the way they did. It was just an incredible experience, and he wasn't there for that. And I just feel like that he really should have been. Just as I think our roles as parents, your priorities are kids, and well, your priorities are your family, and you
above
do
everything
to be there in those moments. Yeah, so that was a really hard one for me, and it's never been spoken about. And then my beautiful stepmom of 20 years and my stepsister. My stepsister, she was only 42, had a double heart attack on Christmas Day a couple of years ago now. And, you know, I was able to get up to Far North Queensland where he lives and spend some time. And that was probably the last time that we had a good occasion together. And then 6 weeks later, my stepmom, so her mum passed away of cancer. The grief really triggered it in her, and he didn't come to that, you know, and there's reasons for him that he didn't come to that. So I'm empathetic towards those. But I guess for me, almost I was like that staff member that maybe showed up again to the expo and the boss didn't show up with the flags and I was like, yeah. I can't do this anymore. And what I was doing, I guess, was I was pouring my bucket out for everyone else, and then I was going home to my amazing wife and kids with an empty bucket. And really putting it on them to fill that bucket, you know, and that's just shit, piss weak behaviour that for me was easy.
I was going to say that becoming a dad has probably changed your perception of your own relationship with your own dad, because you know what you would do for your own kids. But can we talk a bit about that experience? You say that, you know, what you put them through, what did that look like? Because I'm sure relationships, you know, when you're in a relationship, most people do that. It's going to be give and take. There are going to be moments where you really need to show up for your partner because they can't show up for themselves or for the family. Mm. And I'm sure your wife, I don't know her, but I'm sure she would say that you would do the same for her. But what sort of things were going down that you kind of feel emotional or regretful about during that time?
Yeah, well, I guess there's two things interesting. I mean, my memory's not the greatest, so I'll go to straight away that one so I don't forget it. But
sorry, I'll ask about five questions.
No. Just on the points, like, I wasn't there for my wife. Like, I wasn't, I was never. Like, when she was going through big things that are happening in her life, and, you know, I won't talk on those only because they're her story, but I should have been there and I wasn't. I made them a lot of the time all the time about me, and I was the victim in those situations. And then I guess there was the other one where, you know, even at the start where we say, like, I'm away a lot, and then we go, oh, you know, when your kids see what you've been out doing, that's great. But I always think, you know, like, one day will my son and my daughter turn around and go, well, hey, like, while you're out helping everyone else, we were sort of battling on our own, you know, Tuesday to Friday every week. So, you know.
Do you speak with them? Do you have that conversation? Like, you explain what you're doing?
They follow Find Your Feet now on social media. The little bloke's 10 and
you
my
might have a little
30.
Social media manager soon.
Yeah. Probably need one with what I put up. But, yeah, you know, my little bloke, we did a workshop actually with him and his mates a few months ago. Yeah, legend of a mate, just a champion little bloke. He was getting bullied to no end. You know, these kids are 10 and I remember seeing it happening in a footy game, this kid getting bullied, and I said, let's do a workshop. Like, this is going to be epic. 10 years of age, I'd never worked with fellas that age, and the minute that they got an opportunity to share, this little legend stood up and talked about what it's like to be bullied, and he turned around to this group and he said, boys, like, if you ever see me or anyone looking like they're really hurting, just go up and hold them, hug them, just listen to them. And there's all these beautiful young fellas with tears. And as everyone got up to move into this next activity, my little bloke came over, and it's one of the most beautiful memories I've got in life. And he grabbed me and hugged me and just looked at me and said, thank you. Like, that's all he said. So they've got an idea, but for them too, unfortunately, I think they still experience every now and again the old Tommy, you know, because I'm human. I'm not perfect. I'll never be perfect, but there's every now and again, I guess, definitely not like it was, but moments where I'm not, you know, the dad that I probably need to be.
I can see how much you care and like how impactful these moments are for you, which is, yeah, so powerful beyond words. But I guess when we talk about the old Tommy and the new Tommy, what was the change and how are they different?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I give this one with Find Your Feet. We use so many tools at Find Your Feet, but I call this the Find Your Feet intersection. Like, when did we stop going left and doing the easy things? And when did we turn right? And one of my best mates and one of our ambassadors at Find Your Feet is a fellow called Kai Hurst, who we'd all remember as a great Iron Man, like waterman. He's got an incredible story, again, that's his to tell, but he went through trauma that no one, you know, you wouldn't want anyone to go through. And he always turned right. He had a lot of loss, very close people to him. And, you know, at 15 and 16 and then at 17, he wins the Uncle Toby's. You know, my old man leaves, you know, a girlfriend, I come home and there's a girlfriend in you know, with a mate, you know, things. I go left and just go drinking and crying and blaming everyone else instead of going, wow, you know, what a blessing. You know, like, great.
Redirection.
It's out of my life. Yeah, redirection, you know, facing it. So for me, it was that night, really, I guess, where my mate said to me, like, no more. That was the night where I was really lucky. The next day I walked into a place here in Sydney, South Pacific, and put my hand up and I just said, you know, like, I need help. I can't do this anymore. And they said, oh, we're sorry, we don't take walk-ins. And I said, well, I'm not fucking going anywhere. And I had my little dog with me, little red dog, and she's like looked up at the lady and gone like, this bloke's been kicking me. Help me, help him, help his wife at home and kids. And this lady ran from out the back and she put her arms out. And I remember just falling into her arms and we fell on the floor. And I remember just these tears came up from my toes like for about 20 minutes. And I was laying on the floor with her crying. And by then it was just this soft, almost bleating. And around me I could hear like love addicts, food addicts, sex addicts, drug addicts, alcoholics, all the addicts. And they were all talking openly and honestly about their shit. They weren't pretending to be anyone else. And that was the moment where I was like, wow, like, this shit's easy. You've just got to stop bullshitting yourself.
Yeah, you just have to be honest.
Yeah.
And you can do it.
And you got to own it. So that was the moment for me where it really changed. I mean, I had a night, the night before that was probably the worst night, you know, of my life and my family's in a sense. You know, I had a couple of fellas telling me I needed to see the kinesiologist about my stuff and I'm there going, mate, I'm from Tjurgan, like, what the fuck's a kinesiologist, you know? The only thing I know about massage was this old fella who used to volunteer on a Sunday at the local rugby league club and
like remedial.
Do the strapping. What's a kinesiologist? And eventually I just clicked and grabbed a bottle of red wine, sculled it top to bottom, threw it across the house and trashed the house. And I ended up underneath the house at like 3:30 in the morning, banging my head against a wall and blood, you know, coming out of my head. And I remember saying to whoever was in the room, my wife and this other mate who'd stuck around, I want to go home to Queensland. And I was saying, I want my mummy. And I always explain it to young fellas and anyone that I'm working with that what my wife and my mate saw that night and how I was behaving was the 10-year-old boy, the 10-year-old wounded boy that had always gone left and done all the easy shit and never owned his stuff, instead of what my counsellor has taught me to be now, which is the person who walks into their shit and turns it into the skills and tools to become a functioning adult, which is what I can be now. So that was like one of the greatest moments ever for me, that I actually realised that, yeah, I've still got a wounded boy living in me and it's still there. And if I don't look after it, it takes over.
Was there a moment, like, obviously you were in so much pain that night, like just so much pain to get to that point. Do you think it just was a situation where the cup had been filled and it spilled over, or that, I don't know, like, was this a cumulative thing? Looking back with hindsight, you can see all the dots connecting for you to get to that point, that moment of breaking?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's that one. No, there's no woman in the world that would have put up with, like, what my wife put up with for a really long time. I say that with, I just can't thank her enough.
You've obviously told her that. You've said that.
Yeah, probably not enough. Yeah, probably not enough.
What's her response to you saying that?
Oh, yeah, she's always really grateful. But I guess like any human, she has to see it as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love a lot about my wife, is that she doesn't just accept like, hey, I'm going to change. She needs and wants to see that change. And I love that. Like, that's what has to happen. Like, the minute you go and see a counsellor, it's amazing. You've seen a counsellor, but the work begins when you walk out that door on your own. And so, yeah, for me, it was an accumulation of really shitty, poor behaviour over a long time. That wounded boy was 90% of the time me. I argued with a lot of people because I wanted people to know I was angry and hurting about what happened to me in life. Like, I was the loud guy, I was the insecure guy because I wanted to feel safe and heard and loved. Because I felt I was never that.
I was going to say, do you think that's what the fundamental need was? You wanted to feel loved.
Yeah, you want to. And then you know what? I was really blinded by the love that was there. There was heaps of love there. But there's that moment where you've been rejected as well a lot as a younger person. So then you're fearful of putting yourself into that love.
Totally. And you've got to actually, I think this is just from my personal experience, you have to bring it to yourself. Like everyone in the world can be showing you love, but if you don't feel love for yourself, it just bounces off. Like it doesn't even mean anything. You're like, yeah, but you don't know the real me. Like you might love me, but I know the real me and I don't love me. Like when you don't have that self-love and self-worth, all the support in the world, it doesn't help.
No, exactly.
You need to like shift into appreciation for yourself, I think.
Yep. And I guess it's hard as a young person when your parents split or, you know, one disappears. The first thing you say to yourself is, how can you leave me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, am I not worthy?
Am I not good enough?
Am I not good enough? And that was something for me that really played out for a really long time. And then I took it into my life. And again, because it was an easy attitude to have. And I got a lot of attention for a long time on it, which is what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But in an unhealthy way, I kept on doing it. So
what are your belief systems now around why your parents split and why your dad left?
Yeah, they split, I guess, for, you know, that's sort of their story. But I know for mum, like, she probably wanted more love in her life. She did, you know, and she's been with her partner now for, gosh, 33 years. And they're great mates. They argue, they bicker, but they've been together a long time.
Solid.
And so that for me is beautiful to be able to look back and see that, yeah, it was a hell of a long road, but that, you know, they're happy and they're together and he's become one of my great mates. And then, yeah, for my old man, I always wish for him that he can, I don't know, probably own his shit a bit, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a fair call.
Yeah, and step into the uncomfortable and have a conversation with me. I've tried it. It hasn't worked. So, yeah, sometimes I say to young people, sometimes, look, you just got to wave the flag and that's it.
My therapist actually said something to me which I found like an aha moment because it just never crossed my mind that this was a possibility. But she said, you don't have to forgive people.
Mm.
You don't have to. You can try and you can forgive yourself and you can kind of make peace with the situation. But you don't have to have this big moment, this catharsis of like, I forgive you, there's no hatred, there's no anger, love. Sometimes that's just not how it goes and that's okay. And she's like, striving for that is sometimes unattainable and you just beat yourself up for not getting there.
Yeah.
So she's like, it's okay to make peace with the fact that there are some relationships in life that might not have forgiveness, but you can still have understanding around why
empathy.
Why they might have acted or behaved in the way that they did.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be this savior of like, I release all anger from my soul and we're all, you know, sometimes that's just not possible.
No, exactly. And I think that's what's so beautiful. It happens in a workshop, you know, and all these workshops and this stuff, they're sort of built like lived experience of myself. And one of the beautiful, when you sit in the room with someone who's bullied someone, you know, I'll even give you an example.
Please.
Grade 3 workshop the other day, which I've never done before. Like, and it only went for 30 minutes. So let's have a crack. Let's see if it works. And I did this thing, find your feet if you've ever been bullied. And all these people stood up, young people stood up. And one young girl who was, you know, like a bigger girl and everyone sat down and said, find your feet if you've ever bullied anyone in this room. And only 3 people stood up. And one was this little legend lady, like,
good honor for standing up, hey.
Yeah. He's a little legend, this fella. Like, he had a head on him like a bank robbery. It was unbelievable. He had this crazy mullet and mohawk and I said, stay standing if you got the ability to say something to the person you bullied.
Mm.
And everyone sat except for this one legend. I said, mate, who would you say something to? And he said, I said something to a person in this room. I said that they're fat and lazy. And he said, when I said it, I could see how sad they were and I felt really bad. Mm. And I looked around the room and I saw the teacher who was just started crying and and I said, do you know why you did it, mate? And he said, yeah, I was really angry with stuff that was happening at home and I came to school and I took it out on her. And he said, I wish that I didn't. And I knew the girl was in the room, very young age, though, to say, hey, how are you feeling about this? But I could look at her and she was just looking at him like this is amazing. Wow. I've been acknowledged. Yeah, he did something that hurt me, but he's learning from it. And I said, find your feet if you love seeing this fella this way. And 100% of them stood up and said, stay standing if you can give me some insight into what he's normally like. And they all stayed standing. And one person said, you know, like he's normally loud, he's rude, he's mean to everyone. And I looked at him and said, mate, how do you feel about how you're behaving right now? And he goes, I've never done this. And he said, I feel like I'm a grown up. And the teacher's like just sobbing. She just jumped in. She said, I've never seen you behave like this, and I'm just so grateful that you've been able to do what you've done today. You know, he's grade three.
It makes me emotional because I just imagine how different people's lives would be if we were taught these skills as kids, like how to communicate, how to be kind, how to own what you're going through, and also how to feel your feelings and not react in certain ways. Like that sort of work honestly changes the course of people's lives.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just curious as to like how do you feel about that? Do you feel the weight of it, or do you feel like
I mean, I get off planes and probably cry for the first. I'm really lucky. I live an hour and 20 from the airport. I just cry sort of the whole way home.
Processing like, time.
The people that you meet, you know, like my whole opinion on South African people has completely changed to the, like, it's not as if I never liked them, but it's like they're incredibly strong and they're incredibly proud, you know, of their, where they're from. And I had this workshop on the Goldie, this real good-looking rooster standing up and he's got the big blazer on, he's covered in badges and he's popular as. And all the boys are like, they're giving it to each other and giving each other stick, and then they, for some reason, they just focus in on him about he's got all these blazers, all these buttons over his blazer, what he's achieved. I said, mate, you're getting a fair bit of stick here. Like, and he goes, yeah. He goes, it's constant. He goes, actually, I hate it. Mm. And I was like, and one of his mates was like, fuck off, you do, man. You're a simp. You know, you suck up to the teachers. And I straight away, you know, I meet enough of these young SAFA fellas to know why they suck up, you know, like, and why they work hard, put it that way. Sorry, suck up's an awful way to put it. Why they work hard, you know, because they come from a place where a lot of sacrifices have to happen to get them in to come to Australia. Parents, you know, leaving their homeland and coming here. And I said, tell these fellas why you wear those badges. And his face dropped and tears just started pouring from his face. And he said, my parents worked very hard to come here. We left South Africa when I was 12. He said, I work hard because I want them to know the sacrifice they made for me to be here today. And you've got all these boys, as he's saying it, just slowly walking over to him. And then he just sort of clicked him and he's like, and you boys just constantly give me shit. He goes, we give each other shit. None of us celebrate how good we could be. We always just celebrate how shit we can be or how shit we behave. And it was incredible. It just kick-started this conversation in and around empathy and how we can be better. And yeah, I mean, I go on with stories.
You would have hundreds. I imagine this happens in every single workshop. There are moments like this that are kind of like catharsis or realizations for these young people that they don't have to keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. A quick reminder that if you are loving this chat, I would be so grateful if you could take 2 minutes now to jump on whatever platform you're listening to this and leave a review or share the episode you're currently listening to on social media. I'd love to see where you're listening from, if you're going for a walk, if you're at the gym on the treadmill, if you're driving. Obviously, don't take a photo if you're driving. But it is so incredible to see that we now have listeners from over 35 countries tuning in. And the more that we grow, the bigger guests I can bring you. I am so, so grateful that you're here on this journey with me. And I'm excited about the life chats that we have coming up with some absolutely inspiring guests. Thank you so much. I feel like we got so enthralled in the conversation. Just give our audience like a bit of a context on like, where did Find Your Feet even come from? At what point in your journey, we obviously know that you've had a very transformative journey. Mm. At what point did Find Your Feet come in? And what's the work that you do?
Yeah, Find Your Feet, I guess, came in. I mean, I'm a chalky by trade, so school teacher, and I'm really proud of that. I had a chalky teacher when I was young called Crackers Keneally. I gave him that nickname, Crackers. And I was just being a complete dick in class all the time, and Crackers came up to me one day and said, you know what, probably do something with your voice other than being a fucking dickhead all the time. And I was like, whoa. And he was the first fella that actually had given me some constructive sort of feedback. And he literally looked, he goes, I like you, but Jesus Christ, you're wasting yourself, and walked away. And from that night, I was like, I want to be a chalky. I want to be, and I guess with my journey, you know, I was working in education, and I was also in journalism. I was working in radio here in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And one night, this lady was walking around 2UE. I was doing the graveyard shift, and she said, I'm selling chocolates for a young fella who's crook. I met this young fella, Bass Mardrell, and he was just an amazing young man. He'd been given 6 months to live. He'd been wrongly diagnosed for about 6 weeks. Come from Tiwi Island, but living now in Camden. And in that 6 months that I hung out with him, like, he was every bit the man that I was. And I was 32. I was selfish. It was all about me. I was a victim. He was genuine. He was real. He was selfless. It was about everyone else on the journey, you know. And the last afternoon that he was around, he died on a Wednesday, I think it was, at about 6 o'clock. And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, he said, his mum and dad, I want to touch the earth with my feet one more time. And his mum and dad said, they stood him up in his room, and he said to his mum, like, Mum, tell my mates to love life and don't waste it. And I remember when Claire, his mum, rang me, it was about 6 o'clock that night. I remember looking out and my kids were playing, and I was drunk again, and I was playing the victim, and I remember just thinking, I'm not loving life and I'm not wasting it. But I think that one thing that Bass did in that last few hours of his life was he did something that a lot of us don't do, which is stop and find our feet and stand firmly and go, right, like, what should I be doing in this situation? And I feel like a lot of young people, and myself, I use myself as an example, I would get into a situation, the boys were doing stupid stuff, there was a drink on. Instead of thinking about, all right, have I had enough drinks, I'd go, yeah, get me another one. I'm on, boom, and I wouldn't think. So I was never really stopping and going, right, what's the right thing to do? Where for me, like that last message that Bass gave, love life, don't waste it, it's pretty simple. How many of us are loving it and, you know, wasting it, I guess, is a way to put it. So that was for me where Find Your Feet started. I worked for an organisation from down south, and they were all about toxic masculinity and all that. That's great, right? I love that. That was awesome. But in a way, I sort of felt like we're ostracising a lot of people and alienating a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I felt as well. I felt it was a little bit elitist in a sense. Like, a lot of the conversations, I wouldn't have a clue what stereotyping, you know, I understand what a stereotype is, but I was struggling with telling people that they were a certain way. I was struggling when we're going,
keep it a bit more simple for some, like, and just keep it down to basic terms for, especially exactly. Kids.
Yeah, kids. And, you know, I work with year three now, right up to 70-year-old blokes. But the last thing you want to do is go out to the bush where I spend a lot of time working and walk out and go, all right, fellas, no drinking, no swearing. You know, that's the typical Aussie thing to do. We're going to change that around tonight. I go, fuck
off,
mate.
It's not realistic. Yeah.
I've been on a tractor all day, working my ass out. Can't wait for a cold beer. So my whole thing was like, well, instead of telling people not to drink and not behave badly, let's try and show people how to drink. Mm-hmm. So have one or two. You know, if you set a boundary rope, know how far you can go with it. And, you know, let's give you some skills. And so those moments where you have had too much or things have gotten out of control, you lose it. Yeah.
So you started Find Your Feet, and obviously you're working, as you say, in lots of rural communities. Why do you think that those areas have higher rates of, I don't know, mental ill health, or potentially men that struggle with emotions or alcoholism? Like, I'm honestly saying that off the top of my head, I'd have to look into if that's actually the case. But
no,
just from your
own
experience, like, why do you think those areas struggle more?
Oh, yeah, I mean, again, it's a big question to answer, and you're right with the stats. You know, there's a stat like it's 4 or 5 times higher in rural Australia, suicide in blokes.
Is it because it's more isolating?
Yeah, well, it's more isolating, you know, and again, if we look at it simply, we got people who sometimes might only come to town every 3 weeks. And then what they do is they go home and they work their backside off, and they're not working 9 to 5, you know, they're working sun up till sundown, and then in drought they're working, you know, 10 at night, 3 in the morning till 10 at night, and then they're heading out onto their properties and they're feeding, you know, they're having to feed sheep and cattle in times of drought, and they're feeding them cotton seed, you know, which is like feeding them cardboard, but they can't afford to do anything else. You know, you've got rural Australians who are taking punts on a block of land that's going to grow something, and then if, you know, like there's a lot of risk. Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of livelihood. And then, you know, the other reality of it is a lot of these people are getting around with a gun in their truck because they got to shoot feral animals. And when you're going no good and you're down the back paddock and you're, you know, maybe a good hour drive back to the house and you got a gun there and shit's gone pear-shaped, you know, the decision's made. So, yeah, again, like I'd hate to be talking out of school, but in my experience, that's what I've seen. You see a lot of blokey blokes as well as like, fuck, I'm just going to get on with it. You know, we'll be right. And presenting is fine.
For sure. You mentioned that, you know, you work with kids as young as grade three, all the way to 70 years old. What's the one through line that you think is preventing people from healing, from feeling good, from connecting, from sharing? Like, is there something that's common between all these ages and all these demographics, and you've worked in city schools and you've worked in rural areas and you've gone to Kenya? What's the one thing?
Yeah, and that's I think this is like the thing that breaks them. I call it the wall of excuses. Some places I call it bullshit wall. So in a workshop, you know, like I'll say, hey, boys, find your feet. If you've ever been in a moment where you've been, you know, feeling anxiety, find your feet if you've ever been bullied, and find your feet if you've ever felt lonely. And they stand and they sit and they stand and they sit. And there's this moment at the end of like, fuck, that was epic. Like, so much value in the room now. There's respect, there's vulnerability.
They don't feel alone, I imagine.
Yeah, I don't feel alone anymore. I've seen it. And, you know, so they voice that and they say, like, I'd love to hear from someone on one of those, you know, like, give us some insight. And, you know, this is one of the more brutal ones, but a young fella the other day said, I want to talk about resilience, sir. He's another SAFA fella.
Is this when you're overseas? Or
no, this is here, okay, yeah. The school on the Gold Coast where, you know, big private school. Mm. He said, I want to talk about resilience. And I said, who said that? Like, and he stood up. He was this smaller fella. And this is a brutal story, you know, like just on, it's on human trafficking and, warning on it. And he said, I grew up in Joburg, sir. He said, when I was 12, please excuse my hopefully all right SAFRA accent. I love the SAFRA accent. He said, when I was 12, my neighbour, my best friend was 12 also. He said, his domestic worker drugged him and he disappeared. He said, everyone thought he was dead. He said, we had a funeral for him. He was gone. We were broken. He was my best friend. And the whole room just going like, they couldn't believe what they were hearing. And he said, but his father never gave up. His father was resilient. And I'll never forget it. Like, it was amazing. He said he ended up finding him in Dubai in the bottom of a mansion. He'd been human trafficked and used as a sex slave. And by this stage, I'm just like going, this is one of the most incredible stories. And how is this young fella telling this story? He said, Tommy, he was so badly abused that they had to reconstruct his back end. That's how badly he had been abused. And, you know, well, this is the times like when I think of like when all these stories that I hold on to and I never let go of the strength and in that young fella. But he looked around the room and he said, boys, my friend is living back in South Africa. He didn't speak for nearly 3 years after it. He said he was beaten and broken and he's only just started to speak. And he said to me, he said, I will never have a girlfriend. I will never have sex in my life. I will never have kids because I don't like what I've been through. He said, but I will always be here doing everything I can to get through life. And this young fellow looks around the room and he goes, so boys, for me, that is what resilient is. It's pushing through something that you never, ever thought you could do. And I remember just sitting there going, mate, you're the most incredible young fella like I've ever. And he hung around after it and yeah, you don't forget those moments. And so, you know, to go back to the workshop, I say to the fellas, because at the end of them all standing up, I say, you know, why don't we reach out? You know, and this is before they hear any of those stories, and I should have said this before, but they say, because we don't want to be a burden to others. We don't want to seem weak. We don't want to be judged, and it's our issue, not theirs, right? And they say that, and I put a screen up that says exactly the same. Mm. Every bloke in Australia, grade three right through to 7-year-old fellas, use the same excuse. I don't want to burden me, mate. Nah, I don't want to be embarrassed. Nah, it's my shit. I'll sort it. And we use it, right? So I put this screen up, and I go, all right, let's put my mate here, just told that story. Let's put him on the spot. A big thing with Find Your Feet is we give people a platform to tell their story. I give them the skills to own their shit, and then I give them an opportunity to rewrite the culture. So this is where we rewrite the culture of what it means to be fucking solid. Mm. And I said, we're going to put him on the spot and listening, thinking about that story. Who feels burdened by the story that is heard? And the one young fella's like, no way. Like, he goes, I've never thought of resilience like that ever. And I said, who thinks that he's weak after doing what he did? No way, it's strength, it's courage. And so I'm scrubbing out the old excuses and I'm writing up the new stuff.
Beliefs.
Who can relate to any of that stuff? Five or six other boys stand up and he was like, whoa. I'm not the only one. I'm not on my own. So then we're rewriting it of what it actually means. And that shows them that, like, an actual real fella is going to step up. Like my mate did that night on the phone call and go, oi, fuck, come on, boys. Like, we can do better. And by talking the way we have today, we've seen better. Yeah.
I honestly have been, like, holding back tears and, like, just a reaction this entire time because I can't believe, firstly, the impact that this is having on young kids. But just your the way that you would show up for them is something that they would never forget. Like, you remember your teacher and you remember your best friend, and I hope that you find time to acknowledge that and celebrate that, because sometimes all a child needs is a role model or someone to love them and support them. And you speak about this work as if it's, you know, I'm sure you do acknowledge it, but you speak about this work as if it's just any other day for you, whereas this is genuinely changing people's lives. So
yeah, no, I appreciate it.
To say thank you.
Well, you know, like, a leader isn't, for me, a leader isn't someone who goes out and wins races and is the best looking. Is a leader is someone who makes mistakes and then says, hey, I've got to do something about this. And a leader has an impact. Like, you look, you think of a rock dropped in a pond, like, that leadership, it goes out and it hits other people. And one more, a quick story. I was out in the town in Far West and we talk about rural Australia and the impact they have, and this legend gets up, and this is a girls and boys workshop, grade 12, about 40 in the room, and this legend gets up, crazy big mullet, and he's talking about dad. You know, I do this exercise with a big rock, timber and glass. The rock represents all your heavy stuff that we really struggle to move. And if we don't work on it, we trip over it forever, right? So we've got to learn. You're never going to get rid of your shit, I reckon. But you can learn to live with it, you know, so it doesn't dictate your life. And that's what the rock represents. The timber, which is in the middle of the room, is a stick which we can shape, we can break, we can, you know, it's what we're doing in the present, seeing counsellors, training, watching our diet. And then the glass is an empty vessel which you want to fill with all the stuff you do from here. And so this young fella stands up and goes, you know, my rock is my old man. He's constantly at me trying to teach me to be this bloke I don't want to be. Like, come on, harden up, work harder, you know, drink harder. You know, he goes, I just hate it. It breaks my heart. It's brutal. And he went through the rest of it. Anyway, he sat down. Two more other fellas got up. There was a girl next to me who, you know, she was a really beautiful young girl, but you could tell that, like a lot of fellas, she'd been with a lot of fellas, and like a lot of dudes had been with a lot of girls, right? And you could just see those sort of people, and you could see they didn't have much respect for themselves, but they're looking and they're searching to be held and connection, you know. And she was sitting next to me, and she was sort of bagging a few people in this, like trying to bring the level down. And eventually one of the girls got up and said, hey, in grade three, my rock is that I was sexually abused. And all the oxygen went out of the room, and this teacher in the back of the room, just like a huge suction of air, went, she's wailing. And out of nowhere, this legend just gets up, the guy who spoke first, and he walked over to her, but he didn't stand right next to her, which I just loved, like that he respected that. And he stood about a meter away and he put his hand out like that and he said, I just want to say on behalf of any man who's ever intimidated you, any man in this community, in this school, that I'm sorry and I'm so grateful that you told your story today. And it was amazing. Like, the energy in the room just sort of completely, like, went to this, like, whoa, is this happening? And this girl who had that said to her, hadn't been shared that story, hadn't been acknowledged, she just lunged forward and grabbed him and ripped him in, and everyone got up out of their chairs and hugged her and put her arms around her. This teacher behind just wailing. The girl next to me never moved. So I'm sitting there thinking, wow, like, I reckon this has got to be a part of her story somewhere along the way. And everyone sat down. It was at the end of the term. So I was knackered. I was exhausted. And I didn't say anything. I just said to them, look, guys, I'm lost. That was one of the most powerful, incredible moments I've ever been in. And out of the blue, the girl next to me just stands up and just goes, "You," to the fella who spoke. She said, "I don't have much to say other than you're every bit the man that one day I want to end up with. That was one of the most beautiful, caring things I've ever seen. And you've shown everyone in this room what you boys can actually be like." And I remember just looking at her and going, "Fuck, you know, epic girl, go for it." So, like, when I talk about that ripple, those three young people on that day, they would have gone home, they got the weight of the world off their shoulders. Their parents feel the change in them. They're softer, the kids, they're more caring, they're more open because they've got this off their chest. The community feels a greater impact, a positive impact, because you got all this anger out of these young people. And then there's this empathetic thing of like, wow, we've all got stories and none of us know. So let's be really wary next time we just yell something out. So for a lot of the boys in the room that day, they learnt that, hey, there's girls in here that haven't been treated the right way. And the way that we behaved around them, we need to change that. But I do that same workshop in grade six, and you see grade six kids have that impact. You know, like, at a kid stand up, say, "I'm sick of being the class clown," and everyone laughed. And he turned around and he goes, "This is in a big auditorium, about 150 girls and boys." And he said, "No, I'm really sick of it." He said, "I come to school, I do stupid things, like I bang my head against the wall," and a girl laughed next to him again. And he looked at her and he goes, "No." He goes, "I do that to get attention that I don't get at home." And she stood up and she's like grade six again. She goes, "I'm so sorry." She said, I'm so sorry," and just hugged him. You know, that moment, his life changed forever because he got to be the man that he knew he could be. But, you know, this rule book that we've got set as blokes of like, we're not meant to do that shit. We're meant to push it aside. We're meant to just get on with it. We're sorting our fists, you know, and these young fellas step up and young girls step up and they go, "Hey, like, let's just be kinder."
It's incredible what, like, I think children – oh, you got me with that story. I just think children model what behavior can be because they're so pure. They're so untouched by society and pressure and expectations. They just act through love and kindness and care. And if they don't, it's often because they haven't seen that. And I think you're bringing it back to that. You're bringing it back to, like, what do we know to be true as humans? We can care for each other. We're kind. We're loving.
Yeah.
We're innately that way. Yeah, I'm a bit lost for words because I just feel like,
but it's all simple stuff too, isn't it? Like even how you and I have communicated, never met each other, and communicating simply through, you know, Instagram messaging of like, "Hey, how's the States? How's it going? Sick, I live there." And that's easy to do, right?
Yeah.
It's simply being kind and making other people feel heard or acknowledged. But it's right, you know, like what do we see before us? And what I saw with my old man is, you know, and again, for him, like it's not his fault what he saw. You know, he's got his cycle, then there's mine that I have to break. And the other day I was at a school on the Goldie and this legend, 150 dads and their sons. And,
wow.
And, yeah, got to the end, this legend stands up, grade six, stands at the rock and he said, "My rock is my dad's got cancer and he's going to die soon." And it just goes completely quiet and all the boys, like, get up off their chairs, run over this kid because he's crying. And then out of nowhere, you get this voice that goes, "Got to stay positive, son." So I look over and there's his dad. And I said, "Mate, like, give us your story." This guy had run 9 marathons since he'd been told stage 4 bowel cancer. He was meant to die in 3 months. He's been here 4 years. He had 78 weeks of chemotherapy. Wakes up Sunday morning, runs, has chemo, goes to sleep, wakes up Wednesday afternoon. You know, just an amazing story. Gold Coast Marathon, ran in 7 hours 40, vomited like 19 times. The ambulance pulled up in front of him and said, "Get in here. You're going to put you on a stretcher." And he said, "If you touch me, I'll charge you with assault." So he finishes the marathon. But he looked around the room and he goes, "But fellas, I'm getting weak. Like, I can feel that I'm on a shoestring." And he yells out to his son in front of everyone. He goes, "Oh, yeah." And this is the thing, like, I'll never forget stuff. He said, "What does daddy tell you about him dying?" And his young fella looks up through all of his mates and with his beautiful amphitheater. And he said, "To live every life, every day of a life, be grateful. It's a gift, you know." And everyone's in tears. And I'd never been in a moment like that where you're talking to someone who's about to die. And I said to all of his mates, everyone, all the boys in this grade, get up around him, go and stand around him. They're all standing around him. And the dad's standing up and everyone else sitting down, all the other dads, and said, mate, like, what do you want us to do when you die in a few months? What do you want us to do for your young bloke? What do you want the dads to do? How can we be a community around your son? And he simply looked around and he goes, Tommy, I don't want much other than I just want you to be kind to him. He goes, I want you to be kind to each other and just understand that every single day is a gift. And, you know, like I said to the room, we'll never be again in a position possibly where you're going to hear from someone who's, you know, this guy had just been back to Ireland and had his own funeral. He goes, it was the best party ever. I went and said goodbye to everyone that I loved and I've come back here to die with my two boys. You know, like that's that higher power, I guess, we were talking about, yeah, at the start.
I have so many things I want to say. Are you doing all right, by the
yeah,
way?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Yeah, I'm good.
For a while.
No, I'm good.
Speaking of higher powers, like you must witness basically the edge of what I think is humanity. It's like despair, grief, love, all those intense human emotions, people who are dying. You've seen your own family members die. Mm. What is your sort of view on why we're here and the work that you do? Do you think that you've been directed to do it by a higher power?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's... Maybe you sound like a wanker saying,
never.
I reckon, like, so I had this moment with Bass, like the last day I saw him, and he couldn't speak. And I walked into his beautiful little room in his beautiful little house in southwest Sydney in Camden, and like the family was sitting around, his mum and dad are sitting at the end of his bed, and I still can see it. He was beautiful, frizzy hair had gone to, he looked like Gandhi, you know, like he had no hair left. And I remember leaning in to kiss him goodbye on the forehead, and like he'd gone blind. He'd had his 16th birthday the Saturday night. He went to bed Saturday night, didn't wake up till Monday. When he woke up Monday, his liver, kidney, everything was shutting down. He's gone blind pretty much. And when he saw me, like he's like that, and he reaches out and he grabbed my hand and he fucking ripped me in, and he ended up like kissing me, mm-hmm. and he didn't say it, but like in that moment, like he said, mate, don't fuck this up. You're fucking up so much, like, and you know you have. You're here, like, don't fuck this up. And that was the day for me, like, that I feel that I just had this spirit or energy come into me, and ever since that day, like his totem was always his totem is a long-necked turtle, you know, his Tiwi Island boy, and his old man Joey, he's the most beautiful fella, told me that, and I rang Joey and I said, Joey, I just keep getting all these black cockatoos hanging around, man, it's fucking wild. And he goes, man, that's the messenger bird, you know, like. And so for me, it's always now been this black cockatoo. I see it all the time, and then like on his anniversary last year, I was chainsawing on a property up in the Hunter Valley, like chainsaw, rah, all this noise, and two black cockatoos just came and sat on this tree branch like 2 metres away. One flew off and it stuck, this one bird stuck there for like everywhere I walked, it would come and stand on this tree. And so, yeah, for me, I guess I'm lucky enough now to be that messenger that goes around and shares his message of love, life, don't waste it. And yeah, I do. Like I said to her, I'm not a man of, I'm a man of faith, but not in the white robe sense.
I say this all the time. I say I'm not religious, but I'm a deeply faithful person.
Yeah.
It's the only way to describe it.
Yeah, exactly. And I just feel like every time I go into the rooms, the classrooms, or workshops here in sheds and do this, I'm coming so close to God. Like that's, you don't get as close to God as I do. Like, you know, I had a young fella one time who stuck around after a workshop and he was shaking like this, like a leaf, and everyone had left. I was like, what's going on, man? And he said, you know, 2 nights ago I put a gun to my throat and I pulled the trigger. And I said, well, and he said, yeah, the gun didn't go off. And he said, you know, the next day I begged my old man. I never told him what happened, but I begged my old man to take me to the gun club. He said, I just bullshitted to him and said, you know, I want to get better. And he's like, Mum was arguing, you know, that I had to go to school, but Dad was like, no, we go on the gun club. And he said, I got there and he said, I got Dad's Magnum pistol and I went, the one I had in my mouth the night before, I went bang, bang, bang. And I shot, like, just got all these rounds out of it. And he said, Dad actually yelled at me and said, what are you doing? You're better than that. You know, aim it straight. And he goes, that was the last thing I was thinking about. All I wanted to know is why this gun didn't go off the night before. He said, so I was planning on doing it this afternoon when I got home from school. That's what my plan was this afternoon, to go home and take my own life. And I said, are you going to go ahead with it, mate? And he said, no way in the fucking world. He said, I cannot believe my mate over there spoke the way he did and shared his story. He goes, I had no idea he's gone through that. Said, my mate over there, I just had no idea. I thought I was on my own. I thought I was alone. It was amazing. You know, like, that's in that moment, I didn't save him. His mates did. I just was lucky enough to deliver this message and the platform. I said, that young fella, look, I mean, we've got to get some plans in and around you and get you safe. And he said, you can't tell my parents. And the teacher's like, we have to. And we checked in every hour, right? And that was our agreement until he was comfortable with telling his parents. Mm-hmm. And it got to like the 20th hour, been up all night, right? Ring him. And he didn't answer. 4 hours go past and his teacher rings me and she's howling down the phone, like crying. And I can hear this other crying. I'm going, oh no, Jade, like, Jade, what's happened? What's going on? And I'm shitting myself. And out of nowhere, I just hear this, thank you. Thank you. And it's this woman's voice. And then out of nowhere, I hear this young fella. The young fella goes, Tommy, I'm sorry, I didn't check in. He said, I woke up this morning and I walked into the kitchen and I just said to Mum and Dad what had happened. The minute I told him, he said it was amazing. He said, Dad walked to the gun cabinet, you know, because he was a shooter, that was his hobby, and he got all the guns and he put them in the back of the car and we went and got rid of them. He said, and then we went to the doctors and I signed up for a mental health plan and thank you. And so that's how, you know, like, I remember then, yeah, like a month later, because I always go back. It's never one-off workshops. Once I go to a school, I'm there for as long as they'll have me, you know, and we've got 5 workshops that I do. And I went into the school and I was like to the teacher, where's old mate? Where's the young fella? And I looked down the front and he's there, like, he's dack, and he's just about to dack his mate and his mate's about to, you know, dick flick him and doing boy things. And I remember just going, oh, awesome, like, there's one that we saved. But, you know, I probably on average get, especially at the moment, it's bigger, I don't know what it is going on, but I get probably 3 to 5 letters a month that I've had enough, like, I'm checking out. So I've got a lot of work to do, you know, and there's a lot of us, you know, find your feet. And I want to give 2 raps. All of our ambassadors are amazing. Mm-hmm. But I've got one at the moment, Mitch Marsh, who's, you know, he's away from home 10 months of the year more. And he's at the moment directly working with a young person who only 4 months ago texted me and said, I'm out. Like, I'm checking out, 14 years of age. And I told Mitch, after we'd got him safe and got him doctors around him, I told Mitch his story. And within 3 minutes, there was a video sent to me from Mitch, who was in WA, and then he said, give me this kid's number. And he set up a WhatsApp, and every single day he checks in with this young fella and says, hey, mate, you had a, you know, cold shower this morning. I just had a cold shower. I've done 20 push-ups. Had my cold water. What have you done? Mm-hmm. You know, so here's the Australian captain at the moment. He's got a lot of shit going on in his own life, been away a lot, and he's giving this young fella, you know, a whole opportunity in life to live. And then there's another legend, Mad Jack Dore, he jumped off the Balti Bridge, Mad Jack Dore, and survived. And so here he is doing the same thing with another young fella who wrote to me and said, look, I'm out, I'm checking out. And every day he does a gratitude list with him, and there's simple things to do.
Can you tell me now, it might be a good time, I would like, if you're comfortable, for you to show what you've got in your pocket.
Yeah.
What you carry around. I normally go.
Yeah, I normally carry this around in the weather. Yeah, carry that around in my backpack.
Everywhere you go.
Everywhere I go, I take that. And it's a constant reminder of why I do the work I do. And
for those that are listening, not watching, it's a noose.
Yeah, it's a noose. So I was out in far western New South Wales and I was working for this previous organisation. I took a phone call about a minute before a workshop started, and they were pretty upset about that. And I said, look, there's no, for
it's
me,
emergency.
Well, I'd take a phone call at any hour of the day. And it was a mate who said, I'm no good. You got to come see me as soon as you can. And I did this workshop, finished up and bolted out to where this bloke was. And his eyes were just one that way and one straight ahead. And, and he'd filled his car up. He had like an extra long range fuel tank. He goes, mate, this car can get me nearly 1,000 kilometres. He goes, I've already written letters to my kids for their 18ths and their 21st birthdays. He said, I can't do it anymore. I'm done. I'm checking out. And he's a big fella. And I remember like standing there looking at him, and then he had what we call the crazy eyes. Like mine was, and he pulled this out of his pocket, and, you know, the noose out of his pocket, this mini noose. And he said, I know how to tie the knot. He said, I feel like I already have, like I'm done. And it was a 25, 30 minute fucking solid, tough conversation. And at the end, like, I could tell his eyes had calmed down and I could see that. And we checked in every 20 minutes for the first 12 hours. Every 20 minutes I called him.
What do you say in those conversations, in that 25 to 30 minute conversation? Like, how do you know what to say?
Yeah, there's, I guess, for me, again, I need to speak on for myself. I just, first thing I go is, how are you, mate? How you going? And I'd celebrate what they did. I go, you fucking champion, mate. Like, I'm shaking still. That was one of those moments, you know, when you're so close to God, like God right in that moment. Like, I believe that God has a plan. We've all got a plan. And in that moment, who knows if what the figure is above that fellow who I'm speaking to, but is he about to pick him up, pluck him and take him away? Has he already taken him away? And I'm just speaking to someone who's already made their decision. But it's literally, mate, how are you? And celebrating the fact they're still here, celebrating the fact that, hey, we're talking. I want to thank you for what you did. You know, I'm honoured that I'm able to be able to talk to you right now, and I'm going to call you again in 20, you prick, so you better fucking answer. You know, and just blokeifying it or humanifying it maybe with that sort of language. But, yeah, that fella's going much – he's still here, you know, and he's going really well, and he's actually doing this sort of work in rural Oz. And, yeah, so this is like –
Does he know that you carry that?
I don't think he does. I probably should let him know. Yeah, I don't think he does. It was an interesting one. And I've said that a few times. My wife actually said early doors, like, I want you to get that out of your bag. And it was probably back in the day when I was still playing the victim, doing this work, but almost getting around the joint and taking on all these stories and then walking out these doors today and expecting someone walking past to understand. And why aren't you emotional? Why aren't you? And yeah, that's the wounded boy in me. But the functioning adult is like, these people are blessed that they don't have to hear that stuff. Or I think these poor people have to live that story. So, like, there's the empathy I get. So in those days I could understand. And she said to me the other day, like, you've got to get that out of your bag. And I looked at her and I said, hey, like, now the way I am at the moment and how I'm operating as this functioning adult, for me, it's a constant reminder of why I do the work. She's really heavy in climate advocacy. And I said, maybe, you know, it's a little bit maybe for you, like carrying around a thermometer and seeing, you know, this rising.
The urgency.
Yeah, the urgency. Like, that's what is for me. As well, though, I understand you can't save everyone. That's the other one that I have to tell myself daily. We can't save everyone. We can only do what we can do, because if I go out and completely burn myself out, you know, who knows if I'll be here.
I wanted to ask you that. How on earth do you grapple, process, compartmentalize, whatever you do? All these stories you've shared today, I've been in tears, like so emotional, so impactful, so profound. How are you looking after yourself, and how on earth do you honestly balance doing this work?
Yeah, well, I've got to be really disciplined. So I use a lot of the skill. Like, I see a counsellor fortnightly, Elizabeth. She saved my life, amazing lady. I speak to her fortnightly, like, as a rule. I mean, she teaches me really simple things that I use daily. So one is, like, the oops, which, you know, and I pass a lot of these skills and tools on, but the oops is when I start to get voices in my head, I just out loud go, oops, you know, and stop that thinking.
And actually acknowledge that it's there.
Yeah, acknowledge it's there, and I turn it around to, no, you're doing great things, you're capable. So there's, you know, there's the counselling aspect of it that, for me, I used to do, and I explain to young people, it's like seeing a counsellor is like getting your car serviced. You know, like people say, oh, just get your oils changed every 10,000. But I've got an old red Land Rover truck and I love it. And anyone who loves their old cars or trucks knows that, hey, look, don't wait to 10,000. Get your car serviced at 5,000. Change your oil at 5,000. You don't wait for the engine to start to wear. You get it changed a bit earlier. And I'm the same with my way of thinking with my head and my heart now. I used to see Elizabeth once a month or every 6 weeks. And
this
I'd always
like my therapist. I would literally wait until I'd have a massive breakdown, book an emergency appointment, and then go in and say, I haven't seen you in so long. I really need to see you. And she would say, why don't we have maintenance appointments so you don't get to this point? You keep getting to this point every 6 months and we have to do some big intervention to like fix, quote unquote, whatever you're dealing with, whereas we could just talk about it leading up to and have strategies in place. So,
mate, exactly. So I like to explain to young people that it's like, go and get your tyres balanced and, you know, like your wheels aligned every couple of weeks, every couple of months. Just go and check in and look at it. So that's what I call it now. Like we've got a youth worker that works with us, works with me, and I call him our find your feet mechanic, mental mechanic. You know, so it's just a different way of looking at it. I swim every single day. I run as much as I possibly can, but I use the young people's stories. And what I do is, you know, I call this one the find your feet fried egg, and I get the tough story. And instead of feeling really like sad about it and down on it, I think, shit, what about that young person? But what about the way they spoke and how they came out of that? And I flip it and I grow on it and it serves me. So I just ran the Sydney Marathon on no training.
That was on my notes list. I was going to say, can you tell me about what inspired you to do that? But I think you touched on the story of the boy.
The one from Dubai. You know, then I always think of the people from places like Syria, or look what's going on in the world at the moment, and people who walk from, you know, in Syria when people cross the Mediterranean and then they walk through Europe. Like those people didn't train to walk hundreds and hundreds of kilometres and then set up a new home in a refugee camp in a country where they don't speak any language.
Also on no nutrition and probably no water and no shoes.
Exactly.
And like just the most insane, harsh circumstances that we are so privileged to never experience.
Yeah, exactly. So I take those stories and I go, fuck, Sydney Marathon, running around one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Yeah, 2 kilometers. Every 2 kilometers, there's going to be
Gatorade.
There's Gatorade, there's lollies, like epic. And one thing I did on that, around that, which is what happens in the rooms with the workshops, is as I went around and I saw, and I was running and I saw someone who was struggling, I'd say, oi, come on, you didn't fucking pay to walk. And they'd be like, whoa, what's going on? And they'd run up next to me and they'd go, I needed that.
Yeah.
And they'd run, you'd run in there, some would drop off, some would take off. But that's what happens in the rooms.
You know,
other people stand up and they go, oi, man, I never knew you'd done that. That's amazing. Like, I'm sorry you've been through that. You lifted me. Like, that's huge. Yeah, like you need that belief.
We will wrap up soon. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for sharing.
So honestly,
I want to hear, you know, you speak so much about the incredible strategies and resources you have for young people. There will be some people listening to this, mostly I imagine older men, but maybe some older women as well, who were never taught these skills, who don't know how to see a therapist, who think, you know, their problems aren't big enough for that, or they don't even know how to acknowledge how they're feeling or speak to what they're feeling, but maybe they're hurting. What's the first step? What can we do? And how can they sort of take a step in the right direction to not feeling the way they're feeling anymore?
Yeah. I reckon a big one, you touched on it really well before, and you got to love yourself. And that's such an easy thing to say. We get so much head noise. We're our own worst enemies. You know, like for me, I had to hit rock bottom to be able to go and do it. And you have to want to do it. I think the number one thing to do is that it's a bit of an old cliche, but when you look in the mirror, like I'll never forget that first party I went to after I'd been at South Pacific and after I'd learnt that, you know, my relationship with alcohol was really unhealthy, the first party I went to, it was like I was covered in spiders. Like no one came near me because I was drinking mineral water and chatting to my wife and her friends. Even my wife was like, whoa, you're normally the guy at the bloody Barbie taking the piss. I was never on the dance floor because I danced like Baloo, she reckons, off Jungle Book. But it was those three mates four mates that rang me and said, hey, we've heard what's going on, man. You're a legend. Like, well done. I've been feeling the same way. And we call that at Find Your Feet, you Find Your Feet pit crew. Who's in your pit crew that are going to say to you, hey, man, like you need help?
And not being afraid, I think, to reach out to them. I think a lot of us wait and hope that someone will say, hey, I've noticed you're not well or you're not yourself. Is everything okay? And like we all should be doing that and checking in all the time on our friends and family. But also you can approach the people around you and tell them you're not doing too well. Like it's not weak to do that. It's actually probably the most admirable and strong thing I think you can do is just step up and step out and say, I need help.
Yeah. So if you look at like, I love Formula One race car driving, right? You look at those cars, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of euros, whatever they're worth. Mm. Those things race around the track. And in the pit crew, there's men and women in there, right, that do everything to keep that car going at the best it can. Let's pick 4 to 5 men or women that are in that space where they change the tyres. They're your pit crew, right? They've got to have the ability when that car's out on the track to be able to ring up that driver, radio and go, hey, like you're not performing. We're looking at the numbers. Mm-hmm. You need to box. But as well as that, that driver's got to have the ability out on track to drive and go, hey, this doesn't feel right. I've got to come in and box.
So true.
And we've got to have exactly the same thing in life. We've got to be able to be out on track. So out in life and just ring a mate and go, fucking. Like, and I use this language, mate, to go, mate, I'm knackered. Mm. I'm going no good at the minute. I haven't slept. And just the anxiety, like I'm just bit beaten for pace. That's me calling my pit crew. But I've also got to be able to have people in my pit crew that do what my mate did, which was answer the phone and go, mate, no, you're acting like shit. And I'm telling you that because I love you.
You need people to hold you accountable sometimes.
Yeah. But you need to be able to look in the mirror and go, I'm the most important person. But you need those people around you. Like, young people, there's two rules I'd love to to leave on that are big that blokes follow. And I reckon all humans do it, sorry. There's a rule that don't dog your mates and take a risk. So when I say to young people, what does it mean when they say don't dog your mates? Oh, if your mate's, on the piss or he's been on the gear or he's done something stupid, you don't snitch on him. All right, so that's your rule, no problem. And what's the take a risk one? Oh, someone's doing something, you want to do it, you want to impress the boys, you want to fit in, skull, who's the best sculler, who's got the most chicks, you're telling stories about. Okay, so that's take a risk. Let's flip it. Let's do the find your feet fried egg. Let's flip it and don't dog your mates. I reckon you're actually pretty shit, mate. If your mate is drinking heaps, doing heaps of drugs, doing stupid stuff, and you're sitting by and enabling to do that, like you're actually dogging your mate. A good mate is going to jump up and go, oi, what are you doing, Robbo? You're bloody acting like a pelican. Mate, we used to run, we used to surf, we used to enjoy a quiet beer, but now you're getting on the piss all the time and you're hard to be around. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you this because I love you. That's being there for a mate. And then to do that, you got to take a risk because your mate who's going no good might go, well, fuck you, mate.
Yeah, I won't talk to you.
I'm done. Yeah, I'm out. But what you're doing in that moment, and Maddie Hayden's one of my ambassadors, Maddie Hayden taught me this, is you're having conviction. You're saying, hey, this is who I am. And if you don't want to be around it, mate, too easy, but this is what I expect.
This is the standard.
This is the standard. So they're two really tough things to do, taking a risk and stepping up to a mate. But that's what I guess that solid conversation can do, and we've heard through this, it saves lives. So if you've got a mate out there, just ring him and go, oi, I'm in your pit crew.
I want everyone who's listening, this is an order to get off this podcast and try and call. I mean, text if you must, but try and call a friend, a family member, anyone that comes to mind and check in on them. Mm. Leave a message, say you want to catch up for a coffee. It will take 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And do that today.
Yeah. Yeah, I reckon that's a good one. And another one is like, don't always expect your mates to be up.
Mm-hmm.
We always expect everyone to be so pumped. And like you mentioned before, I've just been in Kenya. I was running around in Kenya, like going for runs in Nairobi.
I could see.
Tanzania, just running up to strangers and going, can I train with you? And they're like, yeah,
amazing.
Mumbo rum, come and train with us. And I was taking that energy back into my family, and my bucket was full. I wasn't asking my family to fill my bucket, and we had the best family holiday ever. So the find your feet PowerPoint of a morning, go and plug into something so you can then take that into your day. And when you're feeling really good, or you're feeling like you're up for it, you've got the epic strength to go to a mate and go, oi, how you going, mate? What's going on?
Before we wrap, one more question before we get into the wrap up.
Yeah.
So just thank you so much for today. I'm honestly so grateful. I really take my hat off and admire the work that you do. I think it's incredible. And I would love to be a part of it in some way. If there is any way I can be involved or pay it forward, like, please, we'll talk off camera about doing that. But we've spoken about your kids. We kind of started the episode speaking about you and your personal life and your family. What's one thing, I guess, that a lesson that you want to take from all the work that you do and instill in your children to find their feet?
That's a really big question. The greatest lesson is to break free of this bullshit rule book that we're given and be your own self and be really proud of yourself. I wasn't for a really long time. And I always, the thing we do with Find Your Feet is I say, we've got this Find Your Feet, air your laundry. Mm-hmm. And I say, what happens if we don't air our laundry? Physically, it piles up. Mm-hmm. You know, and in my laundry, there was insecurity, there was alcoholism, there was, you know, school, there was loneliness, anxiety, depression. They were all my shirts that were piling up. Mm-hmm. And that night, you know, that I had that wine bottle experience and threw it, that was the night that I went to get my laundry pile and just threw it out. So my greatest lesson for anyone is start to work through your laundry pile. Brush the fucking saying, don't air your dirty laundry. Because it's bullshit. We've got to air our laundry. Because imagine if we didn't wash our clothes from today and we just wore them. We never wear these shirts again.
Yeah.
But we need to wear these shirts again. You know, if we don't wash our anxiety issues and our depression issues, our loneliness issues, they're just going to pile up. But if we can learn to work with them, we'll get them again 2 or 3 weeks down the track. We'll feel a bit lonely and we'll go, shit, I had this 3 weeks ago. And I got through it.
That's the biggest thing. I think you prove to yourself that you can do it and you fall back on all the times when you're in a tough spot. I do this anyway. I don't know if it helps other people, but like I just remember all the times I prevailed and I'm like, I can do this. I felt severe pain before. I felt grief before. I felt despair and like nothing was going to get better and I'm still here. And if I can do it then, I can do it now.
Yep.
And you just continue to make that promise to yourself that you'll show up and work through it.
We grow. With every bit of fear, there's growth. Without fear, we do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. We have a closing tradition on this podcast, which is that every single guest is asked the same question. You thought we were through the hard stuff.
No,
this is it.
No way.
You can answer in as many or as little words as you like, but that question is, Tommy, what is the meaning of life?
What is the meaning of life? Oh, yeah. And I go back to my little mate, Bass. I think the meaning of life is to love it, to not just throw it away, learn from it. Oh, but yeah, I mean, my meaning of life would be don't make it all about you, which is what I did for so long and I hurt so many people. So if we can step outside that and make it about everyone around us, then like we get given so many gifts and maybe that's what the present is, eh? The gifts we get, so. Yeah, hopefully that answers it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Please tell everyone where they can find you, find more of your work. If they want to get in touch about having you host a workshop, like, yeah, just feel free to direct them.
Yeah, findyourfeet.org. I love that.
Because he's a boy from
Tugan. Yeah, I'm a boy from Tugan. Yeah, people, the smart people spell it T-U-G-A-N, but us Queenslanders, we love T-U-G-U-N, Tugans.
Tugans.
That's the name of our local bowling club. So there's that. And then at findyourfeet on the Insta, which is great. And, yeah, just opened up a shop on there, which is awesome. So selling hats and these shirts, which are
incredible.
Nice and simple and shorts. And that's just to keep fueling myself to get around the country and get the awareness out there. And who knows, someone can look at a hat and go, what's Find Your Feet, your pelican? And you go, it's, you know,
sit
a place
out
where you can go and have one solid conversation that could, shift change forever.
On that note, we'll wrap. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love to hear from next, or if you have a story to share, I'd love to get in touch with you. You can connect directly with me on Instagram at lifechatspodcast, one word. And every review and share really does help so much in the early days of building a podcast. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it on social media, or you can snap a pic of where you might be listening and jump onto Apple Podcasts and give us a review. I really do appreciate the support. More than you know. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, or evening wherever you may be listening in the world. I'm Georgia May, and this is Life Chats.